Hitler's War by David Irving. Chapter is Green. This was the beginning of Hitler's new style diplomacy. On each occasion from now on, he satisfied himself that the Western powers would not fight, provided he made each territorial claim sound reasonable enough. When General Walther von Brauchitsch had proposed to him on March 9, 1938, the strengthening of their defenses along the Moselle and Rhine rivers by early 1939, Hitler had seen no need for any urgency. He was to explain, in a secret Nazi speech to Nazi editors on November 10th, quote, "The general world situation seemed more favorable than ever before for us to stake our claims." End quote. March 17th saw Hitler with his chief engineer, Fritz Todt, unrolling maps and sketching in the new autobahns for Austria. Quote, "Astounding, the fresh plans he is already hatching," recorded Goebbels afterwards, and end quote. Hitler's next victim, as he indicated to Mussolini, would be Czechoslovakia. Through intelligence channels, Prague indicated a willingness to seek a solution to the problem of the Germans living in the Sudeten territories just inside her frontiers. Hitler had, however, no desire to adopt any solution that the Czechs might propose. On March 19th, he conferred with the Nazi Party leaders, including Dr. Goebbels, whom he invited upstairs to his little study in the Chancellery. Over an unfurled map of Europe, they plotted their next moves. The Führer confirmed that Czechoslovakia would be next. Quote, "We'll share that with the Poles and Hungarians," recorded Goebbels in his extraordinary diary afterwards, "and without further ado," unquote. That same day, the propaganda minister issued a secret circular to Nazi editors to use the word Grossdeutsch, Greater German, only sparingly as yet. Quote, "Obviously, other territories belong to the actual Grossdeutsches Reich, and claim will be laid to them in due course," unquote. How stirring it was, reflected Goebbels in the privacy of his diary, to hear the Führer say that his one desire was to live, to see with his own eyes, quote, "this great German Teutonic Reich," unquote. Hitler announced his plan to allow Germany and Austria to vote on April 10th to confirm the Anschluss. The election campaign took him the length and breadth of both countries. On the 7th, he had turned the first spade's depth of a new Autobahn system in Austria. His surgeon, Hans Karl von Hasselbach, later wrote, quote, "The people lined both sides of the roads, for mile after mile, wide with indescribable rejoicing. Many of the public wept openly at the sight of Hitler," unquote. After speaking from the balcony of Vienna's City Hall on April 9th, he took the overnight train to Berlin. As they passed through Leipzig, he remarked to Goebbels that he was working on a plan to ship all of Europe's Jews off to the Indian Ocean island of Madagascar. True, the island concerned was a French dominion, but an hour later he explained that one day he was going to settle France's hash too. Quote, "his life's burning ambition," unquote, Goebbels perceived. Both men voted at a booth on the Berlin Railroad Station concourse. The question on the ballot paper was, quote, "Do you accept Adolf Hitler as our Führer, and do you thus accept the reunification of Austria with the German Reich as effected on March 13, 1938? Unquote. The results staggered even Hitler. Of 49,493,028 entitled to vote, 49,279,104 had done so. And of these, 48,751,875 adults, 99.08%, had stated their support of Hitler's action. This was an unanimity of almost embarrassing dimensions. Hitler had told Goebbels that he would put the former Chancellor Schuschnigg on trial, but that he would of course commute any resulting death sentence. There was, however, no trial. Instead, he instructed Ribbentrop that Schuschnigg was to be well-treated and housed in a quiet villa somewhere. In later years, like so many other Hitler directives, this came to be overlooked, and Schuschnigg went into a concentration camp from which he was liberated only in 1945. On March 24, 1938, Hitler again discussed the next moves with Ribbentrop and Goebbels. He would one day adjust Germany's frontier with France, but he proposed to leave their frontier with Italy unchanged. Quote, "He particularly does not want to reach the Adriatic," observed Goebbels. "Our ocean lies to the north and east. A country cannot throw its weight in two directions at once," unquote. Almost immediately, Hitler started subversive activities in the Sudeten territories. On the afternoon of March 28th, he discussed tactics with Konrad Heinlein, the leader of the Sudeten German Party. Heinlein had been, quote-unquote, discovered by Canaris in 1935 and schooled by the Abwehr in subversive operations. Since then, he had built up a powerful political organization amongst the 3,200,000 Sudeten Germans. Conferring with him in top secret together with Ribbentrop and SS Gruppenführer Werner Lorenz, Hitler gave him two missions. The first was to formulate a series of demands on the Czechs of such a character that, though ostensibly quite reasonable, there was no danger that the Czech leader, Dr. Edward Beneš, would actually entertain them. The second was to use the influence that Heinlein had evidently built up in London to prevail upon the British not to interfere. Military preparations began simultaneously. On the same day, March 28th, Keitel signed an important instruction to the Army and Air Force to modernize the main bridges across the Danube and highways in Austria leading toward Czechoslovakia. On April 1st, the General Staff telephoned General Wilhelm von Lieb orders to report to Beck. Lieb would command the 7th Army, which would operate from Austrian soil against Czechoslovakia. General Beck's own hostility to the Czechs was well known. Manstein, in a letter of July 21st, had written Beck's fierce yearning, that's quote-unquote fierce yearning, for the destruction of Czechoslovakia. In December 1937, Beck had referred to her, in conversation with Jenőr Rácz, the Hungarian chief of general staff, as an appendix on German soil. Quote, "As long as she exists, Germany can't fight any war," end quote. He felt, however, that Czechoslovakia was impregnable to military assault. Beck seemed unaware that modern states were vulnerable to attack by other means, that the army was only one weapon in Hitler's arsenal. Hitler and the OKW, however, saw their future campaigns not just in terms of cannon and gunpowder. Unlike his generals, Hitler knew many of the cards that his opponents held. Goering's Forschungsamt and Ribbentrop's PERS-Z codebreakers were regularly reading the telegrams between London, Paris, and their missions abroad, as well as the cipher dispatches from the Italian and Hungarian diplomats in Berlin. Many a Hitler decision that infuriated his generals by its seeming lack of logic at the time can be explained by his illicit knowledge of his opponents' plans. Germany's ties with fascist Italy were now a fact, and Hitler hoped to sign a formal treaty with Mussolini during his forthcoming state visit to Italy. On April 2nd, seeing off Hans-Georg von Mackensen as his new ambassador to Rome, he once more said that he had decided to write off the disputed South Tyrol frontier region in Italy's favor. Germany's frontiers with Italy, Yugoslavia, and Hungary were permanent. Quote, "Our aspirations," said Hitler, echoing what he had told Ribbentrop and Goebbels, "are to the north. After the Sudeten Germans, our sights will be set on the Baltic. We must turn our interest to the Polish corridor and perhaps the other Baltic states. Not that we want any non-Germans in our domain, but if rule any, we must, then the Baltic countries. If rule any, we must, then the Baltic countries," end quote. Wiesacker recorded these words. He also noted that Hitler had told Neurath on April 20th, his birthday, that foreign triumphs were now coming in thick and fast. He would bide his time, prepare, then strike like lightning. Hitler dared not risk settling the Czech affair until he was sure of Mussolini's support. If in Rome, Mussolini told him in confidence that he was planning to extend his African empire, then Hitler could demand Italian support over Czechoslovakia as the price for German support in Africa. And then, as he once ruminated to Schmunt during April, quote, "I'll return from Rome with Czechoslovakia in the bag," end quote. On April 21st, he instructed Keitel to draft a suitable OKW directive. The tactical ideal would be a surprise invasion, but world opinion would rule out that unless, for instance, some anti-German outrage occurred there, like the murder of their envoy in Prague, the German army and air force must strike simultaneously, leaving Czechoslovakia isolated and demoralized, while German armor poured ruthlessly through Pilsen towards Prague. In 4 days, this main battle must be over. The next day, Hitler sent for the Hungarian envoy, Dome Stoje, and confided to him that in the coming carving up of Czechoslovakia, it would be up to Hungary to recover the territory she had lost there after the World War, including Hungary's old coronation city, Bratislava, Pressburg. Stoje reported reported this splendid news to his foreign minister, Koloman von Kanya, in a secret handwritten letter. The big military parade marking Hitler's 49th birthday had reminded him that his years were drawing on. An adjutant heard him remark for the first time that his acuity of decision was now at its peak. Moreover, an assassin's bullet might always cut him down. On April 23, 1938, he signed a secret decree confirming Goering as his successor. On May 2nd, Hitler wrote out in longhand a private testament, a rare documentary glimpse of him as a human being, putting his affairs in order, arranging his own funeral, and disposing of his personal effects to his family and private staff. The entire Reich government assembled at the Anhalt station in Berlin to bid him farewell for Rome that day. The last time he had seen Italy, in 1934, the Italians had consigned him to a hot palazzo in Venice with windows that could not be opened and myriads of mosquitoes. In his bedchamber, he had clambered onto a chair to unscrew each scalding light bulb in the chandelier. This time, however, in May 1938, Mussolini had provided a lavish reception. For a week in Italy, Hitler could survey the Roman scene and weigh the powers of the Duce against the prerogatives of the king. As his special train hauled into Rome's suburbs on May 3rd, he marshaled his private staff and warned them not to burst out laughing at the sight of a diminutive figure kneeling on the platform, weighed down with gold braid. For that was the king of Italy, and he was not kneeling. That was his full height. Yet there was no escaping the tiny King Victor Emmanuel III. For technically, he was Hitler's host. The royal Camarilla could not have angered him more had they actually conspired to humiliate Hitler, this humble son of a Braunau customs official. The gates of the king's villa were accidentally locked in his face, and at the palace, Hitler encountered suffocating royal etiquette for the first time. The noble Italian chief of protocol led the German guests up the long, shallow flight of stairs, striking every tread solemnly with a gold-encrusted staff. Hitler, the nervous foreign visitor, fell out of step, found himself gaining on the uniformed nobleman ahead, and stopped abruptly, causing confusion and clatter on the steps behind, then started again, walking more quickly until he was soon alongside the Italian again. The latter affected not to notice him, but perceptibly quickened his own pace until the whole throng was trotting up the last few stairs in an undignified gallop. There were other flaws. Hitler had proposed giving Italy a planetarium. Ribbentrop pointed out that Italy already had two, both robbed from Germany as post-war reparations. Quote, "It would seem to me, therefore," Ribbentrop observed in a note, "that the gift of a planetarium to Mussolini might be somewhat out of place," unquote. At a Dopolavoro display, only three gilded chairs were provided for the royal couple, Hitler and Mussolini. Inevitably, the two dictators had to stand, leaving the third chair empty while 100,000 chuckling Italians looked on. At a concert at the Villa Borghese, the nobility occupied the front rows, while the soldiers Rodolfo Graziani, Italo Balbo, and Pietro Badoglio were crowded back into insignificance. This was repeated at the military parade at Naples. Hitler boorishly remarked out loud that these were the generals who had brought the king his Abyssian Empire, at which the row behind him melted away until the generals were in front. Later, Wiedemann subsequently testified. Hitler petulantly announced to Mussolini, quote, "I'm going home. I didn't come to see the king but you, my friend," end quote. He returned to Berlin on May 10th with mixed impressions. His worst fears of Italy's military worth were confirmed. In German eyes, the Duce's most modern weaponry, proudly paraded in Rome, was already obsolete. Hitler was aghast at Mussolini's ignorance of military technology. He would be at the mercy of his generals, he said, and they had sworn their allegiance to the king. The Italians ducked out of signing the draft alliance that Ribbentrop had taken with him, and in Wiesacker's words, quote, dealt us a slap in the face with an improvised draft treaty of their own, more akin to an armistice with an enemy than a bond of loyalty signed between friends, end quote. Hitler had two long secret talks with the Duce on May 4th and told him of his ambitions in the East. Quote, over Czechoslovakia, Goebbels noted later that day, quoting Hitler, Mussolini has given us a totally free hand, unquote. Mussolini affirmed that in any conflict between Germany and Czechoslovakia, he would stand aside, quote, his sword in its scabbard, unquote. The phrase seemed ambiguous, but Keitel's adjutant recorded Hitler's words at a secret speech to generals on August 15, 1938. Quote, what will Italy's position be? I have received reassurances, visit to Italy. Nobody's going to attack us, unquote. Unhappily, no full record exists of the pregnant remarks that Hitler evidently uttered to Benito Mussolini aboard the battleship Conte Cavour. Mussolini recalled him as saying that, quote, Germany will step out along the ancient Teutonic path toward the east, unquote. The upshot of Hitler's visit to Rome had been to discredit monarchies in his eyes for all time. To his intimates, he had in earlier years hinted that he would one day retire and pass supreme command to a contender of royal blood. He would then live his last years as a pensioner in Munich, Regensburg, or Linz, dictating the third volume of his memoirs to Fräulein Joanna Wolff, the more elderly of his secretaries. He had in fact discussed with the late President Hindenburg his plan to restore Hohenzollern to the throne, not so much the crown prince, Friedrich Wilhelm, as one of the prince's sons instead. What Hitler had seen in Rome, however, put all thought of that out of his head. On his return to Berlin, he had Goering contact the former Social Democrat leaders like Karl Severing, Gustav Noske, Otto Braun, and Paul Leuba, and increase their pensions, in recognition of their having dispensed with the monarchy. Nonetheless, he sent routine birthday greetings on May 6th to Crown Prince Friedrich Wilhelm. The prince replied with congratulations for Hitler's contribution to peace in Europe. Hitler dourly remarked to Wiedemann, quote, I'm not here to ensure peace in Europe. I'm here to make Germany great again. If that can be done peacefully, well and good. If not, we'll have to do it differently, unquote. Hitler had evidently decided not to wait over Czechoslovakia. Wiesacker recorded on May 13th, quote, he's thinking of dealing with the Sudeten-German problem before the year is out, as the present balance of power, constellation, might otherwise shift against us, unquote. A cunning propaganda campaign was worked out, beginning with deliberate silence on the dispute. Goebbels briefed the Nazi editors on the 13th, quote, you are again reminded that you are not allowed to report minor incidents in Czechoslovakia, unquote. There was a psychological battle to be won. Meanwhile, Hitler applied his mind to the supposedly impregnable Czech frontier defenses. The OKW advised him that the fortifications were formidable. There were big gun sights, proof against all known calibers of artillery, at 100-yard intervals, and machine gun bunkers in between them. Hitler decided that the attack would have to come from within the fortifications, simultaneously with the main invasion from without. This would be followed by a rapid armored penetration into Czechoslovakia while the Luftwaffe bombers struck at Prague. The foreign lineup against him was now much clearer. Britain was the biggest worry. His agents in Vienna had captured papers revealing the extent to which the British envoy there had egged Schuschnigg on against Hitler. Britain's links with France and the United States were growing stronger. From diplomatic sources, Hitler was aware of the Anglo-French staff talks in London. A decoded telegram of the U.S. ambassador in London, Joseph Kennedy, reached Hitler early in May, indicating that while Britain was prepared to force the Czechs to accept some of Hitler's terms, he would not be given a free hand in Central Europe. After a joint conference with the Navy on May 4th, the Luftwaffe's deputy chief of operations, Colonel Hans Jeschenik, wrote, quote, The general political situation has radically changed recently, with Britain emerging increasingly as Germany's principal enemy, end quote. The Führer had already stated quite plainly to Raeder in January 1938, for instance, quote, "The Führer's impression is that the naval construction program is not progressing fast enough." He compares the naval construction effort with the Luftwaffe's dynamic advance and with the energy with which Field Marshal Goering intervenes and spurs all his factories on. Unquote. The yards lacked skilled labor, welders, and materials, however, and Raeder pointed to the reckless increase in public construction projects competing with the rearmament program. The Volkswagen works, the Munich subway, the reconstruction of Berlin, Nuremberg, Hamburg, and much else. Hitler turned a deaf ear on his protests. His studied recklessness with public funds was sweeping German architecture out of the pre-1933 doldrums. Pretentious new public buildings were springing up, their style frequently dictated by Hitler himself, as he was prone to issue thumbnail sketches of the grand boulevards and buildings. Hitler disliked the formless products of Germany's older school of architects and appointed the youthful Albert Speer as chief architect to Berlin, and the self-taught Hermann Giesler in Munich. To Speer, commissioned immediately to build a new Reich chancellery, Hitler commented that it would be useful for receiving and impressing the quote-unquote little nations. His designs went further than that, however. One evening, in October 1941, Hitler explained in private, quote, "When one enters the Reich Chancellery, one must have a feeling that one is visiting the master of the world. One will arrive there along wide avenues containing the triumphal arch, the pantheon of the army, the square of the people, things to take your breath away. For material, we shall use granite. Granite will ensure that our monuments last forever. In 10,000 years, they'll still be standing. One day, Berlin will be the capital of the world," end quote. Hitler also handed to Speer a project for a vast stadium at Nuremberg, capable of seating over 350,000 spectators. Quote, "In future," he said, "all the Olympic Games will be held here." End quote. On May 17th, 1938, the Führer flew with Major Schmundt to Munich, where Martin Bormann was waiting for him with a column of automobiles. At a stately speed, the convoy swept south toward Berchtesgaden with Hitler's open, supercharged Mercedes in front and his escort and luggage bringing up the rear. From time to time, Hitler glanced at the speedometer to check that they were not exceeding his personal speed limit of 50 miles per hour. His housekeeper and domestic staff were marshaled on the Berghof's terrace. Orderlies stepped forward and opened his car door, and he vanished into the villa. He could hear the Scottish terriers yapping in the distance. He scented the familiar odors of wood and wax polish and thrilled to the great hall's spectacle of the world spread out at his feet below. Picking his way along the narrow paths laid out on the Obersalzberg mountainside, Hitler began to think aloud to his trusted adjutants. He still felt uneasy about his army generals. Fritsch was gone, but there was still Ludwig Beck, the general chief of staff, and Beck was an officer, quote, "more at home in his swivel chair than in a slit trench," unquote, as Hitler sniffed. And there was Gerd von Rundstedt, the army's senior-ranking general. Rundstedt had deeply offended Hitler recently by advising him coarsely to have nothing to do with that, quote, "negroid arsehole," unquote, Mussolini. In Austria, however, Hitler had renewed his acquaintance with General Franz Halder, Beck's deputy. He had already formed a fine impression of still laughing at that. He had already formed a fine impression of Halder during the big September 1937 maneuvers. He decided to replace Beck by Halder soon. While in Berlin, Hitler asked the OKW to draw up an interim directive for Green. It reached the Berghof on May 21st. It opened with a reassuring definition of aims by Hitler, quote, "It is not my intention to destroy Czechoslovakia in the immediate future by military action unless provoked, or unless political events in Europe create a particularly favorable and perhaps unrepeatable climate for doing so," unquote. That same day, news reached him that Czech policemen had shot dead two Sudeten German farmers near Eger, and the Czech government was mobilizing nearly 200,000 troops on the wholly false pretext that Germany was already concentrating troops against her. Hitler angrily ordered Keitel and Foreign Minister Ribbentrop to meet him in Munich. In a secret speech 6 months later, he was to relate, quote, "After May 21st, it is quite plain that this problem would have to be tackled, so oder so. Any further postponement would only make it tougher and its solution even bloodier," unquote. Claiming the backing of Hitler, Goebbels unleashed a press campaign against Prague. Quote, "Ribbentrop is on the verge of tears," he noted gleefully, and end quote. Ribbentrop arrived in Munich, warned by General von Brauchitsch before he left that the army was not ready for an attack on Czechoslovakia. He persuaded Hitler that the press must hold its fire. Schmidt forwarded to Keitel lists of questions asked by the Führer. Could enough troops be mobilized without putting the Western powers on guard? How strong would a German armored force have to be to carry out the invasion by itself? Could the Western frontier be strengthened by the construction gangs? The OKW's replies cabled to the Berghof put a damper on any idea of immediate action except in an emergency. The new heavy howitzers, 15-centimeter trench mortars, could not enter service before the fall because no live ammunition would be available before then. To attack the enemy fortifications, Hitler would have only 23 21-centimeter howitzers, and 8 of these were in East Prussia. All week, Hitler grappled with the decision to attack now or later. He was mortified by the unbridled anti-German outburst in the foreign press. Lord Halifax, the British Foreign Secretary, was tactless enough to write urging him not to make the situation worse, as though it was Hitler who had mobilized. The Czechs and the British even gloated that only Beneš's mobilization order had forced Hitler to back down. By Wednesday, May 25th, his mind was made up. The intellectual process involved by this was evident to his private staff. They could hear him pacing up and down hour after hour at night. War with the Western powers now seemed a certainty. From here on the Berghof, his naval adjutant, the cigar-smoking Captain Karl Jesko von Puttkamer, CA, bled to Admiral Raeder a warning to stand by to meet the Führer in Berlin on Friday, May 27th. Puttkamer tipped him off that there was to be a further acceleration of warship construction since, quote, "The Führer now has to assume that France and Britain will rank amongst our enemies," unquote. Back in Berlin that Friday, Hitler informed Raeder that he wanted the new battleships Bismarck and Tirpitz completed by early 1940. He also demanded an upgrading of the armament of the new battlecruisers, the expansion of the naval shipyard capacity, and the completion of the total percentage of submarines permitted under the 1935 Anglo-German Agreement. Nonetheless, Hitler contrived to give the admiral the impression that the naval part of any war would not begin before 1944 or 1945. Such was the contingency plan subsequently analyzed by Raeder's chief of naval operations, and it was on this time assumption that the naval staff began to formulate its new ship construction program, the Z Plan. Hitler had also decided to begin laying down an impregnable west wall along the western frontiers. Two parallel defense zones, the forward one to be built and manned by the army, the rearward by the Luftwaffe. On Friday, May 27th, he issued corresponding new targets to the army. It was to speed up work on the existing 1,360 concrete pillboxes and build an additional 1,800 more pillboxes and 10,000 bunkers by October 1st, 1938. On the following day, Saturday, May 28th, he called a top-level conference of selected ministers and generals in the chancellery. Goering, who guessed what was afoot, whispered apprehensively to Wiedemann, quote, "Does the Führer really imagine that the French won't do anything if we weigh into the Czechs? Doesn't he read the Forschungsrat intercepts?" End quote. Hitler had invited Brauchitsch, Beck, and Neurath. Ribbentrop was not in evidence, but his liaison officer Huell came with Baron von Biesacker. Goebbels noted in his diary a word picture of Hitler pacing up and down, pondering his decision. Quote, "We have to leave him alone. He is brooding on a decision, and that often takes some time," unquote. Hitler stressed that he would take sole responsibility for his decision. Quote, "Far-reaching decisions can only be taken alone. unquote, Beck noted him as saying, and that decision he now announced, according to Wiedemann's recollection, as follows, quote, "It is my unshakable resolve that Czechoslovakia shall vanish from the map of Europe," unquote. I'm sure he said it without stuttering. He explained to them that they why he had not reacted immediately to provocation offered by Prague's unwarranted mobilization. Firstly, his army was not yet ready to penetrate the Czech frontier fortifications, and secondly, Germany's rear cover in the west was at present inadequate to deter France. However, he said, with British rearmament still 3 years short of completion, and with the French forces still similarly unprepared, this opportunity must be grasped soon. Quote, "In 2 or 3 years," he said, "their temporary weakness will have passed," unquote. He spoke for 3 hours, but when he finished, he had still not indicated to them precisely when, Green, the attack on Czechoslovakia, would begin. Opinions differed. Neurath told Wiedemann as they left the chancellery, quote, "So, we have at least another year. A lot of things can happen before then," end quote. Later that Saturday, Goering instructed his senior Luftwaffe generals to come and confer with him the next day. On May 30th, and again by June 1st, Fritz Todt's diary shows him lunching with Hitler. Hitler formally asked him to oversee the army's construction of the West Wall. On June 1st, the Air Ministry issued its orders for the erection of Air Defense Zone West. The Navy had shown no lesser alacrity. Raeder had evidently stipulated to Hitler at their Thursday meeting that in any war in the West, the Nazis' first objective must be to extend their coastal base by the occupation of neutral Belgium and Holland, because Hitler mentioned this requirement in his secret conference with the ministers and generals on the next day, May 28th. The Army's general staff complied only most reluctantly. Beck suggested to Brauchitsch that they humor Hitler, quote, "for the time being," unquote. Hitler, in turn, commented cynically to Goering, quote, "These old generals will just about manage Czechoslovakia. After that, we'll have 4 or 5 years' grace anyway," unquote. Hitler's policies now turned, therefore, on destroying Czechoslovakia in a lightning 4-day campaign. It would take France at least 4 days to mobilize. To Schmundt, he outlined the campaign as he envisaged it. On day one, his fifth columnists could sabotage the Czech quote-unquote nerve centers, while the fortifications were seized by Trojan horse tactics or bombed by the Luftwaffe. On day two, camouflaged units would secure key bridges and targets between the German frontier and the enemy fortifications. Across these bridges, on day three, would pour the army's mechanized units to relieve the troops that had dug in among the fortifications. And on day four, the divisions awaiting on the frontier would follow, while a motorized formation and the 2nd Panzer Division lunged into the heart of Czechoslovakia. The final OKW directive that Hitler signed on May 30th suggested no date for the attack. The document now began, however, quote, "It is my unshakable resolve to smash Czechoslovakia by means of a military operation," unquote. And end chapter.